Welcome to the best of Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Hello, it's great to be with you on Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. My name's Laura Turner. Well, tonight we welcome to Great Australian Lives a singer-songwriter whose career spans more than five decades. That's a long time in rock and roll. He was the first Australian artist to have consecutive number one songs on the Australian charts with his first two singles in the late 60s and early 70s, and he was inducted into the ARIA Hall of Fame in 2008. He's a true legend of the Oz music industry. It is my great pleasure to welcome to Great Australian Lives Russell Morris. How are you?
Good, Laura. Thanks very much. Good to be with you.
It is absolutely wonderful to have you on the show. You're still going strong. What an incredible career you've had.
Yeah, I've been, people usually say, oh, the false modesty, but it's luck. You really need a fair bit of luck for things to turn around. And after the 70s, the 60s and 70s, I really went into a sort of no man's land for probably 25 years.
Right.
I still worked and sang all the old songs, and I thought I've had my time in the sun, which is fantastic.
Yep.
And I can't complain about that. And I would always go back to singing the real thing, and people still wanted to hear it. And I always hankered. I thought, I'd love to have a new hit. But now I've had my time, and that time just sort of passed, and I worked with Daryl Cotton and Jim Keys and Brian Cadd. We were doing shows, and it was fabulous. And then out of nowhere in 2013, something miraculous happened, which was a big hit album. So I'm very blessed, and that was luck as well.
We'll talk a lot about that big hit album and about The Real Thing as well. But in terms of you, marking 50 years doing this...
Sorry.
That's all right. Do you find that surreal that 50 years, to be still performing now and still be so loved and popular, do you pinch yourself?
Yeah. Well, when I first started, I was going to Swinburne and I was doing a diploma. And I said to my parents, listen, I'm going to leave the last year. I'll go back and repeat it. And I said, by the time I get to 25, I think I'll be too old for the music business, and I'll just go back and finish my studies, and it'll be happy. Yeah.
When I get to 25.
I never really thought that it was a career. I didn't think the music business was a career. I loved it.
Yep.
But in those days, you didn't think rock music was a career at all.
How long had you been playing when you made that decision? I mean, was it since you were a little boy that you loved music and were playing, or did it come a bit later?
Well, I wanted to be an actor.
Oh.
I wanted to be like Boris Karloff or Vincent Price or Peter Lorre.
Mm-hmm.
That was my passion. And some friends formed a band, and their singer was poached by another band, and they said, just join us for Christmas and you'll have some fun. And that was it.
50 Christmases later,
50
here we
Christmases,
are.
Yeah, and it just got under my skin, and I really enjoyed it, and I really enjoyed the process of actually trying to create something out of nothing, like writing songs out of fresh air, really. And I thought that was a really interesting thing to do, and it just became a passion, yeah.
Creating songs out of fresh air, I mean, for most people, to write a song, you can't even imagine, we wouldn't even know where to start, but you do create them out of nothing, don't you? You sort of write words down and see how they work together, and that just is such a foreign concept to most people. How do you do it?
Someone asked me this the other day. Someone was at my place doing some painting. And I said, I could teach you to write a song. He said, oh, don't be ridiculous. He said, that'd be too hard for me. And I said, all right, too hard for me. That's the title.
Yeah.
I said, let's work from there. And we just started putting things together and sentences, and I played a little bit of guitar, and I said, let's try that melody. No, that's no good. Let's try. And I said, you sing something. He said, I can't sing. I said, go on. And I think anyone can learn to write. You just need to be given the signposts and learn like some interesting techniques. David Bowie, for instance, used to collect sayings that he really liked that people would say, and he'd write them all down and then chop them up and throw them up in the air and then pick them up and glue them on a page.
Oh, wow.
And they would form really bizarre sentences. So he would use things like that to stimulate his brain, and Bob Dylan just sits at a typewriter and just types whatever comes into his head. So there's all different techniques.
Mm.
And I think people can learn that technique. And because I did. I didn't know how to write songs. I couldn't even play guitar. So I had to learn to try and play a few chords to learn to write songs. And the reason that made me write, when I was in the band, I was just starting to learn to play guitar because I was only the singer. And I heard a Chuck Berry song. And Chuck has only got three chords in his songs. So I learnt this song and I went to rehearsal and I said to the guys, I think we should do this song. They said, what is it? And I played it. And they were really polite. And then they sniggered a little bit and said, listen, that's a great song. We should do it. However, they're not the chords. And I felt so humiliated.
Yeah.
Three chords and I couldn't even get them right. My ears couldn't hear them properly. From that moment on, I thought, if I write my own songs...
No one can tell me they're not the chords.
Yeah, no one can humiliate me. So that's how I started writing. I thought, to save myself from embarrassment, I'll start to learn to write songs. And that's how I got into it.
And here we are. And one question I just popped into my mind. Did the painter get any painting done?
Oh, he taught.
While you're teaching him how to write a song?
He's a very funny man, Dougie. And he loves a chat.
Okay.
And he probably... He'll be there all day painting and I think probably about...
I hope you're not paying him by the hour.
Yeah, we pay him by the hour. And he'll talk for 3 hours.
Of course
hours.
He loves a chat then. Go on, Dougie. We're on to you.
But he's a good fella. He's great.
Yeah. Oh, very good. Now, you at the moment are promoting your new album, Black and Blue Heart. Where did that come from? From the heart?
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, I'd done 3 blues albums which were really successful, 2 1 arias and... Platinum and gold, and I don't like to become really predictable in music because I like to amuse myself as well.
Yeah, of course.
And I love all styles of music. And what I would do is, in my car, for instance, I'll have Oasis, Steely Dan, Tom Petty, John Lee Hooker, Frank Sinatra, Nat King Cole.
Wow.
A cross section of music. So I just love all forms of music.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd done 3 blues albums and I thought, well, I can't write any more Australiana stuff because people are going, oh, really, another one? So I thought I've written all the stories I needed to write about Australia.
Uh-huh.
I thought I'll just write a rootsy type of album.
Yep.
I started writing and what came out was completely different. And this album was really, really different. And that particular song you're referring to, Black and Blue Heart, my lawyer, who used to be a singer, has always tried to get me to do one of his songs. And we've been great mates for years and the songs just haven't quite gelled. And he said, I've sent you a song. I want to see what you think of it. I wrote it with Gary. And I listened to this song and I thought, it's not quite right for me, but the chorus, I love the words Black and Blue Heart. And I rang him up and I said, do you mind if I work on this a bit? And that's how that song came about.
Mm.
All the others were written over a period of about 3 months. And I think I wrote 35 songs and then ran them by Bill Page from Mushroom. He was the yes or no man. No, yep. That stinks. That's great. We'll keep that.
That must hurt when you're in love with a song and I'm sure you've had it happen a million times and the big record companies go, nah, don't like it, not going to work, next. And you think, oh, that was my baby.
Well, it does happen. Well, Shark Mouth, which I just said, was the biggest seller in 2013. Not one record company in Australia wanted to touch it. No one wanted it. They thought it was.
Do you love it, though, when it does well and you get that, oh, see, I told you so?
No, I didn't think it was going to be a hit either.
But when it was.
Yeah, it was fantastic. I just thought it was a really good blues album.
Yeah.
But I didn't, because blues is never a hit in the charts.
Mm.
So then we went through all these songs, so... Some get rejected and you think, yeah, Bill's on the ball here. So then I did the album with Bernard Fanning from Powderfinger and a guy called Nick DeDia who produced Bruce Springsteen, Pearl Jam, Train, Powderfinger. And we gave the songs to them and they rejected a couple that Bill and I were shattered with.
Of course.
How come they don't want to do those two?
Yeah.
So, and we said, listen, they're the producers, let's let them go with it. And the songs are chosen that way and they were written... I tend to write pretty quickly and with this album, you'll hear a song, sometimes I'll go, last night I said these words to my girl, I know you never even try, girl, come on, come on. So hear the pauses.
Yeah.
I didn't want pause. I wanted things to ramble a lot more. So I thought I'm going to experiment with writing like that. So the lyrics where you think they should end, they don't. They just keep going, mm-hmm. and I ramble a fair bit. Mm. And it was just a style that I'd been toying with. I tried to do it on a couple of the blues albums, and the producer said, "No, no, there's too many words. Too many words. You've got to cut those out."
Mm-hmm.
So we chopped them back, and I thought, "No, I want to do this one day." And so that has allowed me to do this album in a rambling sort of sense of writing.
Now, you're touring this album at the moment, is that right?
Yes, touring and trying to get it out there.
How's it being received?
Really well so far, but it's like you can bake the best cake and you can take it to the party and put it on the table. And
can lead a horse to water.
Yeah, everyone's eating the potato chips and you think, hang on, this cake's really
just
good.
What they're in the mood for. And
yeah.
Like, what about the cake?
And sometimes you'll put the cake on a table that no one actually walks by.
Mm-hmm.
The hardest thing is for an album to
shove it in their face.
To be noticed. If it's not noticed, it's never going to be played.
Yeah. And how do you get noticed at the moment in this day and age, as they say?
Very difficult.
Yeah.
Media, every form of media, you've got to try and get it out there so people go, oh, I might give that a listen.
Mm.
If you can start a few spot fires, it'll start to move.
Because there is so much, I mean, as we hear, but the information overload. We're bombarded at the moment with social media, television, radio. Everything is everywhere all the time. So as you say, to pop up and be noticed and for someone to take you on is much harder than I would imagine it once was. Am I right?
It is really hard. It's better for me as an older artist because I have been around.
Mm.
Although the longer you're around, people think, well, why doesn't he just retire and get out of here? It can be hard, but at least I can sort of get on and people. But it must be really difficult for a young,
newcomers.
New band.
Yeah. Speaking of which, you're playing at the ESPY. You would have played there before, I can imagine.
Yes, yes.
It's new, the ESPY now. Do you prefer now or way back when?
Oh, I think it's still pretty good now. I went there for dinner the other night. It was a bit bloody noisy, though.
Was it?
Yeah.
But are you worried about the acoustics?
No, I think the acoustics will be good. It's great that it's still going. I don't care whether that they've refurbished it, as long as it's still there.
It looks incredible.
Yeah. There's nothing worse than to see things go by the wayside,
such
as record stores and bookstores.
Yes, we'll talk about that. I know they're a passion of yours.
I despair when bookstores disappear.
Yeah, well, so do I. I'm a journalist by trade and, you know, you love the written word. So, But just on the ESPY, I'm really interested in your thoughts on it because I have done the same, sort of driven past it when its future was uncertain and, you know, as a younger girl, been to gigs there and the floor was sticky and there was people there and the atmosphere was alive and it was, you know, it was a wonderful place to hear music. It must feel good as someone who performs live to go back there and to keep living the dream of the ESPY, if you like.
It is. It's good. Better than the alternative.
Yeah.
Pulling it down, you know, which could have happened and been developed into something else. So it is, it's great that they've refurbished it and I love the restaurant next door.
And there was that venue, of course, Festival Hall that they were talking about closing down. For someone who's been around so long, when you hear that, does it hurt?
I don't like to see history disappear, but unfortunately sometimes it does. And it is a little bit heartbreaking, you know, like... But we've got to keep venues, not for old performers like me. It's for the future.
Mm.
You've got to have young bands developing. Australia always punches above its weight.
Mm.
Even we're at a disadvantage in many ways, but there's been some fantastic musical acts come out of Australia and there'll be fantastic ones in the future that are going to have their mark on the world.
Well, plenty more still to come on Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals Celebrating Lives. Coming up, we'll hear how a song undoubtedly changed the life of Russell Morris and would kickstart just more than his solo career.
You're listening to the best of Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals Celebrating Lives.
That's Russell Morris and The Real Thing, his first chart-topping single, bringing us back to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals. Of course, tonight we're celebrating the life of singer-songwriter Russell Morris, who's with me at the moment. That song, I mean, you would have talked about this song, well, for 50 years.
No, I've sung it for 50 years, yeah.
What a song, though. It is bigger than anything. It is huge, that song. Does it still overwhelm you how big that song got?
Yes, yeah. We loved it when we did it. We were convinced that it was a really great song. Thing was is that I didn't think it would last as long as it has. It's even gone into the National Archives.
Yeah, and you hear it attached to so many, you know, in ads and all that sort of thing, attached to so many things. It's such an iconic song. You must get a little spark in your heart, a little bit proud when you hear it.
It's nice, but it's one of those things that you become defined by for such a long time.
Yeah.
So you always think, I'm really grateful, but I'd like to do something else.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's why when new things come along, it is like a breath of fresh air.
Mm.
Not that you'd never, ever want to stop playing
of
the real
course.
Thing. And it's like people say, how do you feel playing it every night? You know, you must get bored. It's almost like you're a professional dancer. You go to the dance and you have a new partner every night. And you dance, say, the tango or whatever it is. You dance the tango. But your new partner makes you dance it slightly differently. And that's what it's like performing that song
to a
different audience.
You love an analogy, I've noticed.
I do, yeah. And that's what happens. You dance with a new partner every night. Mm. And it's like, for instance, doing The Real Thing on Day on the Green compared to doing The Real Thing at the Caravan Club is a very different experience.
Mm.
So it's not too bad. And I find it fresh every time I do it. I don't think, oh, no, do we have to do this tonight?
That is incredible. After 50 years to say you find it fresh every time you do it, I mean, that's the mark of someone who loves what they do.
Yeah, I think so. And plus, I'm one of those people who are quite – I have a persistence about things. I'm the tortoise. I just keep
slow and steady.
I just keep going and nothing daunts me. I tend to keep my head down.
Mm.
If things get tough, I just put my head down and just keep plodding along.
Speaking of things daunting you, was that song one that you thought you would release initially? It was written by Johnny Young, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And did you think it would get as big as it did?
When we recorded it, I thought it would be a hit. I didn't think it'd be a phenomenon like it was.
Mm.
But Johnny Young, when he wrote the song, it was because Johnny approached us once and said, listen, I've got some songs. Are you interested?
Mm.
And I didn't have enough confidence to write my own at that stage. And we said, yeah, let's hear them. And he played us about four songs. This was Ian Meldrum and a guy called Michael Barnett and myself. We said, yeah, they're good. That one's probably good, that one there. Have you got anything else? He said, no, not really. He said, I've got this song I wrote sort of as a joke, but it's a band song. It would never work as a solo artist song. We said, play it. And he played it. And it was very much like Pictures of Matchstick Men, which was a song by Status Quo.
Mm-hmm.
And we all looked at each other, and Ian and I said, that's the song we want to do. And Johnny Young said, you're nuts.
You're crazy.
He said, that's not a solo artist song. We said, that's why we want it. And Ian Meldrum decided that he was going to completely changed the animal, which was the song. He said, we're going to do like a hurdy-gurdy man meets I Am the Walrus.
Mm-hmm.
And he put it together. And the whole architecture of the song was Ian's. If it hadn't been for Ian Meldrum, that song never would have been what it was.
And it was his decision to make it as long as it was, wasn't it? It was only supposed to be half that length originally.
Yeah, that was an accident.
Right.
The band finished playing the song, they got to the end, and the drummer did a drum fill and they went into double time. And the engineer went to push the talkback button and say, that's it, guys, thanks. And Ian went, nah, let him play, let him have some fun.
Yeah.
We'll just edit it or we'll just fade it. And they played and played till the drummer threw down his sticks. And Ian said, don't worry, we'll fade it. The next night Ian rang me and said, I've got a great idea. I said, what's that? He said, we're going to make the single 6 minutes long. And I said, Ian, that's insane. Radio will not.
You're off your head.
They won't play it.
Yeah.
And he said, no, we'll make it like an EP. For those people out there who don't know what an EP is, a little black disc.
Mm.
And they used to have a divider in the middle. You could actually physically see it. And he said, when the needle gets to that line, the DJs at their own discretion can fade it or leave it on.
That's the radio edit, I guess.
And I said, well, what do you do with the rest? I said, what do we do with the other 3 minutes? And he said, don't worry, lovey, I'll put sound effects in there. And I said, Ian, how many sound effects can you put in?
For 3 minutes.
Yeah, and that's what he did. And that's how it happened. And he was phenomenal. And the odd part about it is luck plays an enormous role in people's existence and what they do. And in mine, I've had some incredibly lucky moments in my life. When I first joined my first band, Somebody's Image, there was another band around at the time called The Group. They felt sorry for us because we couldn't get any work. And so they could have more drinking time. They were working at the Anglesey Life Surf Lifesaving Club. And they said, do you want to do a set in between our sets?
Yep.
So we went down, you know, really pumped up, and we did a set. Unbeknownst to the group, which was the GROOP, they didn't know that I surfed at Torquay and Anglesey. And the whole crowd were all my friends. We went on and played, and the crowd went nuts.
Yeah, wow.
And there was a guy there standing with the group who was their mate, who had been pestering them to let him manage them.
Right.
And they're going, don't be an idiot. You're just our friend. You're not a manager.
Yeah.
So he saw us, came up and said, "What are you staying the night?" We said, yes. Can you meet? We'll meet on the beach tomorrow. I've got something I want to talk to you about. He said, came the next day and said, I'd like to manage you guys. I'd like to produce your records and I'd like to get you a record deal. We had no, this guy had no credentials.
Yep.
And as you did, being back in the 60s, being so naive, we went, yeah, that'd be a good idea. And that was Ian Meldrum.
I knew you were going to say that. How Australian is that? You're a band in on a, you know, in a surf town. You met on the beach the next day, and the guy who makes the break for you is Molly Meldrum.
And it's unbelievable. And who? What are the odds? This is what where the luck comes in. What are the odds that that guy would turn out to be one of the best record producers this country's ever seen?
And was it his idea, you know, that umama mama, you know, in the wheel thing? Is that, was that his?
I can't say, I can't talk about this because Ian gets, it's Ian's idea. Yeah. But I say that what Ian said to me, Russell, I'd like you to sing in the chorus, I'd like to you to,
Really? That's, so that's how
no,
that came.
No, no. It was a guitar line.
Right.
And Ian told me to sing it. So I sang the guitar line. Yeah. It was supposed to be a wah. Wah, 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 wah.
Yeah.
Which was taken from pictures of Matchstick Men Again.
Now, we've talked about how the length of the song did. You obviously had to get it, you know, okayed by the record company. Did they? What did they think when they when you played it to them? Because they, well, came down.
They came down from Sydney, yeah. And Ian was terrified that they were going to hate it. And John Sayers, the engineer, and myself were saying, "Don't be ridiculous! They're going to love this. It's fantastic." And he's saying, "No, no, lovey, they're going to hate it." And he started to drink. He's drinking and drinking. Finally, they arrive and at the airport and they ring up and said, we're on our way now. Ian panics and takes the tapes and disappears. Mm. So they arrive, want to hear it and get really, really angry when it's not there. So we have to go and find Ian to get the tapes. We put them on.
Where was he?
On the golf course across the road at Albert Park. We put them on and play it.
What, was he playing golf? He was just golf course.
He was hiding. It was night. Yeah, it was nighttime. So we get there and play it, and they're sitting there, and it goes through, and we're all smiling. We look around, and Ian was right. They hated it.
Oh, no.
They turned on their heel and left and then rang us the next
day. What, and said, we're not playing this?
No, they rang us the next day. They didn't want to get into a confrontation then. Said it's the biggest load of rubbish they'd ever heard, and they weren't going to release it. In fact, they might release it in Melbourne, but they're not going to release it Australia-wide because it was an embarrassment to the company. So,
wow, they ate their words, didn't they?
Yeah, so Ian and myself jumped in a car and drove up to Sydney and went and visited all the radio stations, which you could do in those days. You go to 2SM and 2UW, knock on the door, and they say, oh, come in. Who's the program director? Oh, this is Ray Bean, blah, blah. Can we have a cup of tea? Yeah. So sit down and have a cup of tea. We've done this record. What do you think?
Yeah.
And they'd go, fantastic. Can you sign a petition that you're going to play it? So we had to get people to sign, present it to EMI, and EMI said, okay, we'll release it.
Right. So they changed their tune a little bit.
Especially when it was a big hit.
I can imagine. Now, it was a big hit, not just here, but in the US as well. Places like Chicago, Houston, New York, very big there. That breaking into America, I mean, still, even now, is a huge achievement. You must have felt overwhelmed by that.
It was. It was great. It would have been a much bigger hit in America, but I was on a tiny record label called Diamond Records, and they were an independent. And at that particular time, the majors who, like an independent record label for people out there listening, is like mum and dad's shop on the corner.
Yeah.
And so mum and dad have got, say, cornflakes that they want to market, but they want to get them to the rest of Australia. So they'll go to a major distributor like Coles or Woolworths and say, can you put this on your shelves?
It's hard to get it on the shelf.
Yes. And in America at that time, the major record companies didn't want independents succeeding. Mm. So they really only gave them a very minimal amount of exposure. Mm-hmm. So the markets where Diamond was strong, we did really well, Texas, Chicago and New York. And in fact, the other day I met a guy, an American, and he said, I remember when I was in New York, he said one of the college stations there was flogging the real thing. He said it was like everyone was into it, you know. Yeah. So I think if it had gained mass exposure across America, it might have been
even bigger.
But probably it was meant not to happen.
I might have
ended up a drug addict and dying on the floor in some hotel room.
Rocking and rolling a little too hard.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, the rocking and rolling didn't happen as much in the UK. They didn't receive the song as well. Do you blame that on Beatlemania at the time?
No, actually, unfortunately, I blame it on one of my dear friends who's passed away. It was his fault.
Really?
Yeah. His name was Steve Hands, who I really adore. Mm. Or I did, and he confessed to me years later. He was at EMI at the time, and he convinced them not to release it.
What?
Yeah, he didn't think it was going to work in England.
How is he still your friend?
He wasn't my friend at the time.
Oh,
he became my friend.
Right.
He then moved on to, he went to Warner Brothers, and we became really good friends.
Yeah.
And one night when he was drunk, he confessed to me, said, I am so sorry I did something to you, blah, 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 blah. So it never worked because of that. Yeah.
Oh.
So it never saw the light of day in England.
Speaking of Beatlemania, though, when you returned to Australia in 1969, you played a pretty big gig, didn't you, where a number of people were actually taken away in ambulances because they were so hyped up for seeing you. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I think it was a sport, though, with people. Like in those days.
Because we can all remember the girls at the airport
screaming and,
you know,
running and someone gets knocked down and people run over them and things like that. And like, it was like a sport and they would try and be wilder and wilder.
Right.
And it was a hard time to perform though. I remember performing up in Brisbane at one stage and this was what made me change my whole thinking. And I'm singing away and the kids would have managed to get hold of the microphone lead and they'd be tugging on it and all of a sudden they'd tear it out of the microphone. So you'd grab another mic and finally they'd torn all the microphones out and I had one dead microphone in my hand pretending to sing through it and the crowd still going nuts and I thought, this is insane.
Yeah.
This is insane. I don't want to do this anymore.
Yeah.
So from that moment on I thought, I'm going to write my own songs. I'm going to become a singer-songwriter like Cat Stevens, Neil Young, Bob Dylan, and I'm going to do my own stuff. If it sinks, so be it. I'll go down with the ship and I will only do my own stuff from now on. And that was the decision I made and I thought I'm just going to tone things down. I don't want to be a teeny bopper hero anymore because I didn't really enjoy it.
Well, plenty more still to come on Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals Celebrating Lives.
You're listening to the best of Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
But I can see under your guard, I can see your battle scarred. You've got a black and blue heart. You've got a black and blue heart. You've got a black. Little bit nervous. the sad may be true, but you try to hide it so well. You're cautious, unwilling, and maybe unable.
Well, that's the title track to Russell Morris's new album, Black and Blue Heart, bringing us back to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals. Tonight, we're, of course, celebrating the life of singer-songwriter Russell Morris. Russell, there are some intriguing titles on the new album, Witness Protection, Fat Man and the Priest, and Black and Blue Heart, which we've talked about. After 50 years, where do you draw the inspiration for the song names and the lyrics as well? I mean, you've got to get them from somewhere.
They seem to pop into my head. Sometimes I'll hear someone make a statement and I think, wow, that's a really nice, I like the words, the way they run off each other, and I'll write it down. I'm a voracious reader. I read lots and lots of books, and that's almost like putting oil into my brain. It allows me to stimulate my thoughts. Witness Protection, strangely enough, came from, I'm couch potato as well. I love watching sport, and I also love watching movies. And one of my all-time favourite directors and favourite movies, Martin Scorsese, Goodfellas, which was about Henry Hill, who he squealed on all his mafia mates and they put him into witness protection. At the very last scene, Ray Liotta, who played Henry Hill, is standing in his driveway in his sort of still gangsterish type of clothes, looking at all his neighbours mowing their lawns and walking their dogs and the confusion on his face. And I thought, that's an interesting concept. That's how that came about.
It takes a bit of a brilliant mind to recognise that, though, and put it into a song. You've got to admit.
No, I think everyone can see those things. It's just a matter of
But they've got to recognise that they've seen it.
Yeah, I think, you know, people have their favourite things they do, you know, and they think, gee, I love that. I love the way that, I love in that movie, in Terminator, the way blah, blah, you know, someone could take that, you know. It's a matter of actually taking the steps to do it. Some people can't take those first couple of steps.
I've listened to a lot of interviews you've done and you've talked at length about your decision initially, not with this album, but you know, a little while ago, to get to putting blues into an album, because you sort of struggled with that initially, didn't you? Because you say you're not an American. They talk about Mississippi and that sort of thing. But you fused Australian history and the blues together, didn't you? And you've made it your own.
Yeah, that was also luck. I had written about, because I'd intended, because I started doing the blues, and when we met Ian said, no, you've got to be more commercial. And we became more commercial and we had hits and we thought, well, gee, he knows what he's talking about. But I always hankered back to do rootsy, sort of bluesy stuff. I started to write a blues album. I'd written about four songs and I thought, they're not quite right. And I remember one was called Red Hot Chili Pepper or something, Chili Pepper Woman. And I thought, it just doesn't, they don't feel right to me. And I was in Sydney and I saw an article in the newspaper about a guy called Thomas Archer who was called Shark Mouth. I think they actually called him Shark Jaws. And the photo was just, I was transfixed. I thought, what a photo. So I took it home. I came back to Melbourne one Sunday afternoon. I was sitting there looking at it. And it was almost like it said, son, write a song about me. Bring me back to life. Let people know that I lived and walked this earth. And I wrote the song, and it was almost like he stretched out from 100 years and touched me. And it was like, I understand. I'm going to write a song about people from that era. And blues works because blues music was around in 1925 and 1916. So it's the great glove for the hand to fit into. So I thought that you, for instance, you couldn't do it as a dance modern record or anything like that. It had to be bluesy or country. But my gravitation was towards blues. And I thought, well, no one's really done it. And I thought, I'm going to give it a go. And when I did it, everyone, same as the real thing, not one record company wanted it. No one thought it would work. And so I guess that taught me a lesson. Find things that people don't like.
But you've told some incredible Australian history through these songs, haven't you? I mean, there's tales about Squizzy and, you know, the Great Depression and all stuff that your grandmother would tell you about back in the day.
Well, my grandmother, we lived in Richmond and Squizzy Taylor was primarily from Richmond. My grandmother was a young woman would walk up Bridge Road, and she said, I would see him over there on the corner of Bridge Road and Church Street in front of the Vine Hotel with all these thugs. She said he was a little squirt. And strange enough, he was called a standover man, but he was 5'4".
He used to stand under man, I think.
Yeah, stand.
He's as tall as me. Yeah. That's so not he, tall.
So he was but a very dangerous fellow. And
Well-dressed, though, wasn't he?
Yes. Mm. And those stories I would be regaled by those stories. And I remember as a young kid, my parents would drag me down to the corner of Crown Street, and we'd go around the corner from Burnley Street, and there was a lane there, and he was a guy in the lane with a bag over his neck taking bets from all the neighbours.
Oh, wow.
And there'd be someone on the corner watching for the police.
Yeah.
And if the police started coming, this guy would whistle. The guy would close his bag and sprint to the end of the lane. A gate would open. He'd go through the gate, and allegedly he'd go through the house to the next street, across the road into the next house, out into their backyard and out the gate.
Oh my God.
And they had it all covered.
Yeah.
And all those things. And I went to Richmond Tech, which was a very scary school, particularly for a fraidy cat such as myself. We had people there who were later on involved in the great bookie robbery, the great diamond heist in Collins Street, quite a few murderers and gangsters. So it was, and I wasn't a tough guy.
Yep.
So I think that's how I learnt to be an entertainer, because tough guys, there's no honour in beating up the school idiot.
Mm.
And I was the school court jester. So there was no reason for them to beat me up. You know, because if I was a tough guy trying to stand up to them, I would have got many, many hidings.
Right, yeah. Speaking of Richmond and colourful characters, Molly Meldrum is one of them. I think I certainly know he did live in Richmond.
He still does, yeah.
Right, in the house with the paint on the fence.
Yeah, paint on the fence. The Saints on one side and Storm on the other.
That's right, that's right. You spent a lot of time with him. You must have some incredible stories about Molly Meldrum.
He's a very funny man and an extremely intelligent man.
Yeah.
People always thought, oh, I'm bumbling Molly. But Ian is very, very clever, one of the cleverest guys I know. In fact, he has a way of creating his own publicity, and it becomes a phenomenon. I remember when we were in England, Terry Doran, who was the Beatles press secretary, said to Ian, while you're here, Ian, you're going to meet the boys. And Ian's going, oh, I love the Beatles so much. I love the Beatles so much. He said, I promise you. So Terry rings him up and says, Ian, we're going to a party tonight, a very special party. So if you're Ian, what would you think? He said, you're going to be very excited. So Ian goes, okay, gets to the party. Here's the Beatles sitting in a corner. Terry goes up to Ian and says, Ian, come on, I want to introduce you to somebody. So Ian goes through the party. Here's John Lennon sitting around. John Lennon swivels in his chair, and Terry says, John, this is Ian Meldrum from Australia. Now, what would you do so John Lennon never, ever forgot you?
Mm.
You faint at his feet.
Oh, did he really?
Allegedly.
You wouldn't imagine he would ever get starstruck, Meldrum. I suppose John Lennon.
Whether he did faint, who knows? And John Lennon immediately
already
goes,
already been drinking.
Who is this? Who's this idiot? Who's this moron?
No.
And they say, that's Ian Meldrum from Australia. John Lennon never forgot who he was.
That is an incredible story.
I've seen him do similar things, like with the Monkees and things like that. And people go, who's that? Who's that guy up the back? Who's that guy on the plane making all that noise? And that's Ian Meldrum. Mm. Bring him up here.
Yeah.
Bring him up here.
Well, he got noticed, didn't he?
He's one of the most cleverest guys I've ever met.
Yeah.
And a lovely fellow. He's like still one of my best friends.
I was just going to ask, you're still in touch?
Yeah. No, not as much anymore because I live in Queensland. So when I come down, if I've got some time, I always go and visit him.
Mm. And Molly and yourself would be two men who are so passionate about, you know, while things have changed and we're now downloading music off the internet and, you know, Apple Music and all that sort of thing, you still love a vinyl, don't you? You still love to touch and feel, you know, the physical vinyl in the shop.
Yeah, whether it's old-fashioned or not, I'd like to, if I read a book, I want to be able to hold it. I want to be able to bend the pages. I want to scribble in the column at the side if I want to. I don't want it on a pad. Mm. I don't really, it's not tactile enough for me.
Mm-hmm.
Same with CDs or vinyl. I want to be able to hold it and look at the cover and flip it over and open it up and things like that. And I am a little bit that way. And I guess it's just my nature. With modern society, a lot of people just like to stream or download. And unfortunately, with streaming, people cherry pick a bit.
Mm.
They have playlists.
You're not listening to the
so
whole
they don't
album.
Listen to a whole album. They don't get the whole concept. Like, I would hate to think, you know, like albums like Pink Floyd, Dark Side of the Moon, that was a concept.
Mm.
You would have to listen to the whole of that thing. Abbey Road's a concept album. You'd have to listen to it in its entirety. Cherry picking I'm not a big fan of cherry picking because what it does is it sort of singles out the most commercial songs that it's
takes a song out of context a little too, doesn't it?
That's right, yeah.
Well, plenty more still to come on Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funeral Celebrating Lives with Russell Morris when we return.
You're listening to the best of Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals Celebrating Lives.
My pillow is my destination and my dreams are taken.
Well, that was another one of the wonderful tracks on Russell Morris's new album. That was Full Moon, and this is Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals Celebrating Lives. Russell, what's that song about, Full Moon? Is it literal?
It is. It's literal. It's about myself. I'm probably the most lazy person. I love to sit on the couch. I can, if we weren't talking now and I was just sitting in this room by myself, I'd probably fall asleep on the desk. I'm just one of the, and I've always been
like
it. How
lucky are you to be able to sleep?
Yeah, even when I was really young, I could get on a plane, 10 minutes of taking off and fall asleep.
I'm so jealous of people like
I'm
you.
I'm just one of those people that just, so it's sort of, it's literal about myself. And I just, sometimes I just want to curl up, lock the door and let the whole world pass by while I'm sleeping.
I'd love to do the same. Now, Russell, will we see a day where you hang up the guitar for good?
Well, there's always that day that's going to come. And
I don't want to sound like I was saying that longingly, of course. You have an incredible career and talent, but do you see that happening?
Yeah, of course. When I've got nothing to write about or when I start performing and you look out into the audience and there's like 50 people. Fortunately, the last 5 years have been full houses virtually everywhere. So as long as people are interested to hear what I've got to say, I'll do it. Or until the point I can't do it anymore. I enjoy it. I've often thought about cutting back and doing maybe 6 months a year, but I haven't gotten to that point yet. Maybe next year I might only do 6 months, but who knows? How long's a piece of string? And you never know. Each step is one step before the other one, and you never know how many have you got left.
We look forward to it. Thank you so much for being with us tonight. It's been an absolute honour and pleasure. Thanks.
Thanks, Lauren. I hope you get some sleep with the bubbies.
Thank you. I'm going home to my twins tonight. Well, join me again the same time next week when we celebrate another great Australian life for Tobin Brothers Funerals Celebrating Lives.
You're listening to the best of Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, Celebrating Lives.